This is April 1st, 2018, and in the spirit of April Fool's Day, I'm going to have a little fun this morning, read from one of my favorite old books called The Life and Letters of Tofu Roshi, and this is by Susan Moon. It was written 30 years ago. I met her at a conference and I was able to personally thank her for this. According to what I could see from my records, it's been 29 years since I did a Taisho on this, so I'm guessing that it won't be old news for many of us. The foreword, by the way, is by Gayan Wilson, the cartoonist. So just in the introduction, talks about how she first met Tofu Roshi. It was in traffic school in 1975. No comments. Tofu Roshi, she says, Tofu Roshi was in traffic school for going the wrong way on a one-way street. There is no one way, he told the instructor. I didn't know he was a Buddhist priest at the time. He was dressed in coveralls with a red wool cap pulled down over his shaved head. But during our lunch break, I was struck by the fact that he bowed to his peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and he had extraordinarily pendulous earlobes that dangled down and swung back and forth when he bowed. This is an allusion to a iconographic convention of with Buddha figures, of having them, showing them with long earlobes. It's supposedly one of the 32 marks of a Buddha, is having long earlobes. She says, I supposed he was another one of Berkeley's marginal people. When I met her, she was living in Berkeley, at the Berkeley Zen Center, barely keeping his act together on the outskirts of society. I forgot about this nondescript man, nondescript except for the earlobes, until I saw him again at a co-ed dancer-size class at the Y. He was the only man in the class, or so I thought, which made a good impression on me, as it indicated a certain freedom from traditional sex roles on his part. This time I saw that his head was shaved. He greeted me with the injunction, "Drive carefully." And to which I responded, "How many ways to go on a one-way street?" He laughed and held up one finger as if testing the wind direction. He moved with remarkable grace for one so pudgy, and he hummed along with Donna Summer as we did our leg lifts. When we parted at the door of the Y, he shouted after me, "Not two!" But I never returned to the dancer-size class because the music was not conducive to my spiritual development, and I still didn't know who he was. The third time I saw him was some months later at the Next to Godliness laundromat. He was folding his clean laundry into three piles, brown, gray, and black. He smiled at me when I came in. "Keeping in shape?" he asked. Things had been going from bad to worse for me. I was overcome with a sense of meaninglessness and had come to the laundromat in a distracted state of mind, looking for lost socks. Consequently, I didn't recognize him. I thought a strange man was making a pass at me, and I didn't answer. A few moments later, I pulled my head out of a dryer in time to see him leaving the laundromat, his telltale earlobes swaying to and fro. I ran outside and caught up with him at the corner. "I'm sorry," I panted. "I didn't recognize you at first. I keep losing my socks." As if this would somehow explain my rudeness. "Do you live around here?" "No way," he nodded. "I'm the priest at the No Way Zen Center up the street. Would you like to join us for the afternoon meditation?" And so began my new life. I was quickly caught up in the rigors of Zen practice, guided and inspired by the teachings of Tofu Roshi. I will never forget the first Dharma talk I heard him give on how to give up self-improvement. A week later, when he spoke on the miracle of mediocrity, I knew I had found my perfect master. In a matter of months, I became one of the dozen residents at the No Way Zen Center, quit my job at the meatless pemmican factory, and began to work as Tofu Roshi's secretary and Gal Friday. You will read about these events in the pages that follow. All right, I'm just going to pull out some selections here. She says, it was I who persuaded Tofu Roshi to start a spiritual advice column in our local newspaper to answer the needs of those desperate seekers after truth who struggle alone in the dark with no one to turn to. And then much of what you'll hear here are the questions and answers in this advice column. So the first one, dear Tofu Roshi, when I meditate, I seem to exhale more completely than I inhale, and consequently, by the end of the meditation period, I feel quite deflated. What do you think I should do? Prudence bird whistle. Dear Prudence, proper breathing technique is widely misunderstood. You are not alone in having trouble with it. From your letter, it sounds as though you may be making a common mistake, breathing out more times than you are breathing in. This is why we recommend counting breaths. Only by counting can you be completely sure you are exhaling and inhaling the same number of times. One of my students uses golf counters for this. With her left hand, she enumerates inhalations, while with her right, she takes a count of exhalations. At the end of the period, she checks to make sure the numbers on the two counters are the same. If there is any discrepancy, she takes an extra moment to even things up. Adding the indicated number of exhalations or inhalations. But it is best to alternate whenever possible. Breathe in once, breathe out once, then go all the way back to the beginning of the cycle and repeat. This is a basic principle of Zen. Dear Tofu Roshi, I am easily distracted by noises while I am sitting zazen. The other morning, somebody was trying to start a car just outside the Zendo window. We all know what that sounds like. That it used to be much worse before they got it together with car starters. But we used to sit here and listen. 63 times they tried. The few times the engine actually turned over, it seemed as though the whole Zendo held its collective breath until the engine would die again. I came out of there a nervous wreck and arrived at work grinding my teeth and cracking my knuckles. My boss said, "You seem a little tense. Why don't you take up meditation?" How can I achieve inner peace? And then it's signed, Distractible. Dear Distractible, it has been said that the bird song outside the Zendo window will not disturb us when we understand that we are the bird and the bird is us. We face, admittedly, a greater challenge in becoming one with the car that will not start. Think of your arms and legs as wheels, your eyes as headlights, your belly or hara as a carburetor. The mat on which you sit should extend 2 inches beyond the rim of the rear tires. Rest the left front cap gently on the right front hubcap. Dear Tofu Roshi, I can't sit on the floor. I understand that my spiritual advancement is therefore severely hampered. What to do? Stiff. Dear Stiff, many people share your difficulty. Those who begin to practice the way late in life find it particularly difficult to tie their legs in knots. Some young people who are abnormally, quote, uptight, also have trouble. You might find it helpful initially to practice your knots on a length of rope. All of us should know the square knot, clove hitch, inside clinch, double carrick bend, and studding sail halyard bend. Anyway, when you can do these knots with a rope, transfer the learning to your legs. Another approach is an architectural one. Cut a footwell in your floor, which will beautify your home at the same time that it will enable you to sit comfortably on the floor. Do your best and remember this. If you are sitting on a chair and the chair is on the floor, you are sitting on the floor. We can even say, if you are sitting on a stool which is sitting on a chair which is sitting on a table on the floor, you are sitting on the floor. Be careful not to fall off the floor. Dear Tofu Roshi, every time I sit sashin, I am overcome with a desire to go out for ice cream. Now, this is not as funny as it sounds. I've heard in my contacts over the years with people from some California Zen centers that it's kind of their little guilty pleasure during sashin to go out for ice cream. In between sashins, I don't think much about it. There is an excellent ice cream store around the corner from our Zendo, just 5 minutes walk away. And during sashin, we have a break for 20 minutes after each meal. So, last sashin, I planned it all out. During early morning zazen, I thought about a caramel sundae with Rocky Road ice cream. I continued to think about it all during our breakfast of rice cereal, seaweed, and carrots, and tofu. When the break came, I set out for the ice cream store, gazing casually at the sky and trying to look as though I was just seeing things as they are. The ice cream store, which is also a coffee shop, was really crowded with people out for Saturday morning breakfast. I ordered my sundae and told them to hold the maraschino cherry. By the time I got served, I had about 3 minutes to eat my sundae. I must say, it was really delicious, even though I got caramel sauce on my robe and people looked at me funny. I hurried through the door of the Zendo a few minutes late, trying to look as though I was enjoying my breathing, and when I reached my place, there on top of my zafu was a maraschino cherry. What does this mean? I felt so embarrassed, I hid it in the fold of the chanting book. Signed, Sue Ann. Dear Sue Ann, why didn't you sit on it? What is a maraschino cherry but a tiny red zafu? Buddha is everywhere. And then here is another introduction to a chapter where she says, it took me months to feel sure that no way was my way. But even in the first few days, I noticed some immediate and profound changes in myself. Roshi had given me the practice of counting my breaths up to 10. Soon I couldn't stop counting up to 10 in my everyday life outside the Zendo. By the way, just a serious note here. This is a misunderstanding that I picked up from my introductory workshop in 1970, was I thought that if my practice while sitting was counting the breath, that I should continue it all the time. And I've run into others who have the same misunderstanding. No, it's if while sitting your practice is counting the breath, you can do it during kinhin, but at other times outside the sitting, you just try to become one with whatever it is you're doing. I found myself compelled to chew each bite of food 10 times, whether it was yogurt or celery, and I felt a rush of satisfaction every time I counted my fingers and toes. And then she talks about Doksan. I've been living at No Way for about a month. My interest had been deepening, but so had my discomfort at what I found to be a disturbingly authoritarian power structure. That very day, Shusan Saki, it's one of her fellow practitioners, had castigated me for leaving a pair of socks lying around for days on the bottom shelf, the one reserved for the head priest's footwear. That is, for Tofu Roshi. So I went into Doksan with a chip on my shoulder. The first thing you are supposed to do when you come in the door is bow to the teacher, but it was at that moment impossible for me to bow to Roshi because of the chip. So I sat straight down on the cushion, my heart in my breast, and waited for his response to my defiance of his authority. Nothing happened. He sat facing me with downcast eyes while I listened to the rhythmic buzz of a fly. Would he ask me to leave? To come in again and do it right? What if he made me polish a brick until I could see my original face reflected in it? The fly's buzz changed to a sort of snuffle, and all at once I knew that this was no fly, but the sound of Tofu Roshi snoring. And there's more, but I'm going to skip the rest. Back to the advice column. Dear Tofu Roshi, is there a gourmet guide to spiritual practice places? My wife and I need to know, in choosing our path, where we can get our dietary needs met. I have heard of Zen centers where peanut butter is the mainstay of every meal. But we are more interested in something in the nouvelle cuisine line. Radicchio, chanterelles, that sort of thing. When you give up all your ordinary activities, food becomes even more important than usual, and that's saying something. This is something I observed in Asia when I was on my pilgrimage, training with the monks and nuns, in some cases nuns, and how I could not believe the quantities of food that they ate. Words fail, but I realize that's about the only real pleasure they had was food, and so much becomes invested in food. My wife and I wish to spend our summer vacation on a long retreat, Sesshin. I am overweight, and I hope to lose pounds but gain insights, about 20 of each. My wife, who is very slim, is allergic to wheat and milk. I should perhaps add that neither of us is enthusiastic about the idea of eating seaweed. In some of these extracts, you get a sense of what the diet and other things are about the Berkeley Zen Center and the San Francisco Zen Center. Neither of us is enthusiastic about seaweed, and we wonder if people have been able to get enlightened without it. One more thing. Cooked carrots make me gag. What do you recommend for us? And this is signed Ori O.K. It's good. An Irish name. Play on Orioki, the bowls, the nesting bowls in traditional Zen practice. Dear Ori, do not make false distinctions. Food is Buddha. We are Buddha. When we eat ourselves. Your hair is seaweed. Your legs are carrots. Do you not like your legs? Eat your legs raw. You are what you eat. So is your wife. Dear Tofu Roshi, I'm studying Buddhism at a Zen center where the priest shaves his head and nobody else does. My problem is that I am completely bald. People think that I must be a priest too, and they act extra holy around me, walking on the balls of their feet. That's another little hint at what is expected there at that Zen center, and speaking in whispers. Or what's worse, they think I shave my head in order to be taken for a priest. Sometimes I wonder if our priest feels jealous of my glistening scalp. His is so whiskery. As my grandfather used to say, God made a few perfect heads, and the rest he covered with hair. How can I clear up the confusion? Do you think I should get a hair transplant? And then signed, Bald but Unenlightened. Dear Bald, I don't think one hair would make much difference. Several would be required, would they not? but it is not necessary. We do not say in the Prajnaparamita, no eyes, no hairs, no nose, no tongue, no... No, do we not say in the sutra, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind? Do not let small-minded people pull the wool over your eyes. Dear Tofu Roshi, I'm desperate. I've been meditating for 10 years now, and I still haven't experienced enlightenment. At least I don't think I have. I went to my family doctor for a complete physical checkup just to make sure there was no physiological problem. He says I'm the picture of health except for my plantar's warts, and he doesn't see why they would stand in the way of enlightenment. Recently, I returned from a month-long meditation retreat. I thought by the time it was over, I would surely experience the big E. People were calling out all around me, moaning and exclaiming with transcendent rapture. But I just sat there, trying not to scratch. Roshi, what if they're all faking? What if it's just a big hype? Should I fake Satori too? Then I'd get some respect. But luckily for me, I had a religious upbringing, and I know that if I simulated enlightenment, I wouldn't be cheating anybody but myself. After the retreat was over, I asked the guy who had been sitting next to me, "Have you had Satori?" He replied coolly, "That's a private matter I prefer not to discuss." Another time I asked some people in my Sangha if they'd be interested in us forming an ongoing support group for pre-Satoric beings. But they looked at me like I was suggesting we start a massage class for people with contagious skin disease. Oh, Roshi, is there really such a thing as enlightenment? And if there is, why don't I ever have it? And signed, Virginia. Dear Virginia, yes, Virginia, there is enlightenment. You will know it when you have it. But let me tell you something in confidence. People who do experience Satori are often disappointed to discover that their lives are just as dreary afterward as they were before. No big deal, as they say. When you are enlightened, you will realize that you already realize that which you will realize when you are enlightened. Dear Tofu Roshi, at a sesshin, you get to know people really well in a certain way. You get to know their physical presence, how they walk and bow and chew their food, if they do chew. Well, here is my problem. When I go to a sesshin, instead of becoming more open and loving as the retreat progresses, I become more and more critical of the sentient beings around me. Who doesn't know that experience? At our last sesshin, there was a man who, after each step in walking meditation, would nod his head with satisfaction, as if he was congratulating himself for being so holy. And there was a woman who, when she pressed her palms together to bow, crooked her little fingers as if she was drinking tea at Windsor Castle. At such times, I am choked by rage. I want to break things. I flush with hot anger at every ladylike bow or self-satisfied nod. Do you ever feel this way? In my normal life, I'm a fairly nice person. Signed, Gladys. Dear Gladys, once I had a student who could not stop from plucking tiny wool balls off her sweater all during Zazen. She provided us with an opportunity to practice patience and tolerance. One day I noticed with some relief that she had finally rendered her sweater completely threadbare, but she arrived the next day in a new sweater and began work on it. About halfway through a long retreat, in order to facilitate the release of tensions such as you describe, I often have the community join together in a sort of modified game of charades in which each person takes a turn to imitate the irritating foibles of another. While the onlookers guess who is being impersonated. We all feel much closer to each other after our little improvisational theater session. Dear Tofu Roshi, Over a year ago, I started dating a really loving, emotionally mature man. We realized immediately that we were completely compatible, and we soon became serious about each other. We continue to be involved in a warm and deeply satisfying relationship. We have no problems. Help! What should I do? I have no past experience with this situation. And then signed, Blown Away in L.A. Dear Blown, we always have a problem. If it's not one thing, it's another. This is our life, to work on our problems the best that we can. I want to encourage you. You may be overlooking something. Does he ever forget to put the top back on the toothpaste tube? If the answer is no, and you can find no other difficulties, I suggest you plan to spend the holidays together and have as house guests as many relatives on both sides as possible. Or take a long automobile trip together. This often turns something up. I wish you luck. It would be a shame to have to break off such a beautiful relationship as yours for lack of a problem. Dear Tofu Roshi, I joined my local Zen center because I want very much to meet a gentle man who has attained enlightenment. I figure that's the kind of guy for me. However, I've noticed that all the single fellows at the Zen center are incredibly anal retentive, if you'll excuse the jargon, and don't know how to express their feelings. Now that's just ridiculous. When my wife likes to remind me that when we met, I wouldn't know a feeling if I found it in my soup. I'm a real warm, expressive person who believes in letting the love I feel for others flow out of me. I was talking to a guy after Zazen and telling him about my breathing. When I gave him a little hug to say goodbye, he jumped back and shouted something in Japanese or Sanskrit or some other language like that. Then he pointed to my shoes on the shoe rack and said, "Please don't use this shelf of the shoe rack. It's reserved for the priests." I thought that at a meditation center I would find some men who had learned to let their soft self out, but maybe I've picked the wrong tradition. Do you think I would have better luck in a Vipassana or yoga center, for example? Angela also likes to remind me that her main memory of me before we got married was when she came to the center when there was no sitting and rang the doorbell, which got me out of bed. And when I opened the door, and I growled at her, "What's wrong? Don't you read the schedule?" Then this is signed Yinny. Dear Yinny, as in yin and yang, you know. Dear Yinny, cruising the meditation halls for a love partner is not the path to enlightenment. You must let go of your goal-seeking behavior if you wish to succeed. You must convince yourself that you are meditating in order to save all sentient beings. As for where to look, my observations are that Vipassana meditation seems to attract many therapists, while poets and artists are drawn to the Tibetan practice. Cooks and carpenters like Zen, and yogic practice appeals to burnt-out academics. So keep these trends in mind as you look for a man who can express his feelings. Dear Tofu Roshi, my husband is a Buddhist, unfortunately. He has lately taken on a lot of responsibilities over at the Zen Center, and now it seems like he spends all his free time over there, sifting through ashes for stubs of incense and cutting paper napkins in half. For anyone doesn't know, we do that actually at the center. Oh, we did it for decades until we came up with napkins that were half size to begin with. Or so he says. The dog hardly recognizes him anymore. And as for me, I bet he doesn't even remember whether my belly button is an innie or an outie. But when I suggest to Sam that he is neglecting important aspects of our family life, he looks at me like he can't believe how unenlightened I am. I'd like to know what's so significant about sifting ashes, anyway. I mean, every single day? Couldn't you just leave a tiny little stub of incense in there for a day or two without completely ruining your chances of freeing yourself from the cycle of rebirth? And this is signed, Sam's Sarah. Dear Sarah, there is nothing important about sifting ashes. That is why we do it. Try to convince your husband that there is nothing important about your family life either, and that there is nothing to attain by walking the dog or fulfilling the marriage vows. Tell him that if he walks the dog, it is emptiness and form, and if he makes love to you, it is form and emptiness. Hopefully, this will awaken. Hopefully, this will awaken his interest. Dear Tofu Roshi, my life is a mess. When I began meditating a few years ago, I had a lot of trouble with my knees. Sitting in lotus position was excruciating. But I persevered. I have a lot of willpower and patience, and when I have the time and the inclination, I have a lot of willpower and patience when I have the time and the inclination. I get it. Finally, I was able to sit in full lotus for 12 hours a day. Painlessly, and then for 24. Unfortunately, since that time, I haven't been able to straighten out my legs. I've been going around on my knees and elbows for 3 months now. I wear my daughter's skateboard knee and elbow guards while she's at school and doesn't need them. But now she and my wife have started teasing me and threatening to buy me a leash and collar. Also, it's difficult to prepare meals. What should I do? Do you think a person stuck in full lotus position can fulfill his role as husband and father? Signed, Lotus. Dear Lotus, you could try preparing meals on a hibachi grill on the floor. I think you can be your daughter's father in any position. And as for being a good husband, to your wife, make this an opportunity to explore new territory in the marital relationship. Dear Tofu Roshi, please help me. I think Mom and Dad will be influenced by your opinion. I'm a 13-year-old girl with a problem. My folks are Vajrayana Buddhists, and until last year we lived in a big Buddhist commune. I learned to put my palms together and bow before I learned to walk or talk. The other kids and me used to sneak into the meditation hall and build playhouses out of the cushions. I used to think everything round was called a mandala. Fried eggs, car tires, mom's boobs. All us kids had names like Chakra Samvara and Hanuman. I like mine best because it was the longest, Avalokiteshvara. We recently had to move to a suburb of Cleveland because of Dad's job, and now I go to the local junior high. None of the kids in my class ever heard of a mantra, and nobody can say my name, not even my teacher. She says the human brain was not constructed to remember names of seven syllables. Now I want to change my name to Kitty, so I don't feel like such a weirdo. But my parents got all uptight about the idea. They say my heritage is nothing to be ashamed of. They always call me by my whole name, even though by the time they get finished saying it, they usually forget what they were going to tell me to do. Or else I did it already while they were saying my name, like cleaning up my room, for example. I asked Mom how she would have felt if her name was Avalokiteshvara instead of Bootsy, when she went to Lake Forest High School. She said she probably would have wanted to change her name to Avalokiteshvara if she'd heard of it. She tried to change her name to Iphigenia, which was the most exotic girl's name she knew of at the time, but everybody except her best friend kept right on calling her Bootsy. I shouldn't have even asked her, knowing what a weirdo she is. I guess she's satisfied now, though, because before I was born, Rinpoche gave her the name Ramalakirti, but Grandma and Grandpa still call her Bootsy. Another problem is I don't dare invite anybody over to my house because my parents are still working on their 100,000 prostrations. This is a really valid and not uncommon practice in Tibetan Buddhism, is to stabilize the mind and develop some humility. You start by doing 100,000 prostrations, which may take months or however many you do a day. And they usually are doing it right when I get home from school. I'd die of embarrassment if anybody saw. Even if we just went in the back door, you can still hear them clunking down to the floor over and over, and the floor squeaks each time, and Dad's knees make a weird popping sound when he gets up. Oh, I don't know about that. Clunk, squeak, pop, clunk, squeak, pop. I wish my parents would embarrass me in normal ways, just like making the bed creak when they're doing you-know-what. But they probably never do it. They have to spend all their time bowing. I don't want you to think I don't love my parents or anything like that, because I do, even if I give my mom a hard time sometimes. For example, I used to love it when they let me polish the brass statue of Manjushri on the altar, and now I never want to do any of that stuff. Why don't you want to do it anymore, Avalokiteshvara, honey? Mom said. I'm just not into it, that's all, I said, and Mom started to cry. I guess they're too far out for me. I'm just not that type of person. What should I do? Do you think I can get my parents to act more normal? Kitty. Dear Kitty, you are in a difficult situation, but remember that your parents are struggling to keep their belief system alive in an alien environment, and this is probably why they overreact when even their own daughter no longer wants to support them in their religious practice. I seriously doubt that there ever was a 13-year-old whose parents didn't embarrass him or her at one time or another. But I suspect that most young people are embarrassed because their parents are so square and dull. Perhaps you can take an advantage of necessity. Just be direct. Say to a friend, "Want to come over after school and watch my parents do prostrations?" You are now entering a difficult period in your relationship with your parents, but keep the lines of communication open, and when they are a few years older, they will be able to accept you for who you are. Dear Topo Roshi, my brothers and I have had it. Mom is on a health food kick, and she keeps trying to get us to eat tofu. She slips it into everything, thinking she'll pass it off as chicken. But we know that chickens don't have cubic breasts. So you are the only one we can think of who might know what we should do. We only eat regular food. Teddy. Dear Teddy, this is not my field of expertise, but I must clear up an apparent misunderstanding on your part. Tofus don't have cubic breasts either. In any case, my family name is not for food, but for a mountain in Japan where the wind in the trees whispers, "Tofu, tofu, tofu to you too." We eat what is put before us, no liking, no not liking. If somebody puts a Brussels sprout in your Halloween bag, receive it gladly. Dear Topo Roshi, we have a wonderful son in college now. He's always been a good boy and had a paper route and everything. He was just home for a visit, and there was something changed about him. You could tell from the look in his eyes that his mind was maybe elsewhere, and I think I heard him speak to his soft-boiled egg before he cracked it. Now, this would be a reference to, in Japanese, there's this, an expression you say before eating. Roshi always used to do it before a meal when I was with him. Itadakimasu. My husband said to me, "Mom, our boy's on drugs." So we read the pamphlet, How to Tell If Your Child is on Drugs. But it didn't say anything about the egg. Personally, I'm beginning to think he's meditating. I mean, when we're not looking. How can you tell if your child is meditating? Sometimes he breathes loud. And signed, Mom in Occidental. Dear Mom, loud breathing in combination with the incident with the egg may indicate something. Count his breaths to see if he exhales and inhales the same number of times as I recommend in my teaching. If so, he may be one of my disciples. Here are some other things to look for. Does he eat maddeningly slowly, chewing each bite as if to bring time to a complete standstill? This book was decades before the raisin method of mindfulness recommended by John Kabat-Zinn. Take 30 minutes to eat a raisin. Has he developed a peculiar preoccupied walk as if his feet are sticking to the floor? Does he bow to inanimate objects? Does he leave his shoes outside his bedroom door? Has he asked you to do likewise? Unlike the youth on drugs, the youth who meditates is likely to suggest to his parents that they make certain changes in their, quote, lifestyle, such as sitting on the floor or eating with chopsticks or even doing both at the same time. Watch for the physical paraphernalia that show up in the home of a meditator. Incense, of course, is one, as are flowers on top of the toilet and round, firm cushions about 16 inches in diameter. Furthermore, different symptoms may indicate different kinds of meditative practice. The sufferer who repeatedly lies down on the floor on his stomach and then gets up again is probably on the Tibetan path. The one who takes up hugging of parents and prolonged wordless eye contact may be doing some kind of Christian contemplation, or perhaps nothing more addictive than group therapy. If your child manifests a new obsession with symmetry, folding his paper napkin neatly and lining things up at right angles or parallel to each other, silverware, pencils, toothpicks, he is probably practicing Zen meditation. I can't tell from your letter whether you have cause for concern. You might seek help from your local support group for parents of meditators. Additionally, you may send for my booklet, How to Tell If Your Teenager is Meditating, which expands upon the comments I have just made. All right, that's all the time we have. If nothing else, at least you got some sitting in this morning, and we have brunch in a few minutes. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind matter. I vow to uproot beyond measure, I vow to meditate the directed way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.